Welcome to the Frictionless Innkeeper podcast series. Our show is brought to you by the Frictionless Guest app, which allows innkeepers to provide guests with their recommendations of the best local places to eat, play, and shop during their stay. The Frictionless Guest app is accessible through all mobile and desktop devices, and you can learn more about it by visiting frictionlessguest.com. Once again, that's frictionlessguest.com. I'm Matt Langan, and I'll be joined by Steve Short, the founder and CEO of the Frictionless Guest app. And today we're speaking with Brian Ontiveros-Kirsch with Bedbug Advisor, which is a specialized organization that provides public education and resources for the treatment and elimination of bed bugs. And for this episode, Brian will be providing us with an enlightening discussion on the issue of bed bugs in the hospitality arena and what innkeepers can do to prevent and mitigate bed bugs at their property. And Brian and Steve, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Doing great. Thanks for joining us. Steve, how are you?
Doing well as always, Matt. Thanks. And thanks, Brian, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And of course, thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, this is quite a unique topic that we've never really covered off on in this podcast series. And certainly a lot to learn and a lot going on, Brian, based on the prep call that we did last week. So before we talk about Bedbug Advisor, tell us more about the overall bed bug issue and history that is common today.
Oh man, where to start? So bed bugs, as we all know, are part of a nursery rhyme that I'm sure we've all sung growing up. And for most of us, that's all bed bugs have really been. I know for myself, I didn't realize bed bugs were a real thing until I got this job and had to get deep into the world of bed bugs. And there's actually a pretty good reason for that. So between 1941 and 1982, the U.S. actually embarked on a campaign to try to eliminate the spread of diseases from mosquitoes. In particular, the West Nile virus was a big concern, and malaria was another. So the U.S. government actually went on a campaign to spray what is DDT. It's a pesticide. And they sprayed everywhere in public parks and schools. And I'm sure if you were growing up during that area, you remember the trucks coming down the street in your neighborhood. And we actually stopped it in 82 because we realized there were some detrimental environmental side effects. We were killing things that we didn't mean to be killing. So bald eagles was actually the primary reason. The bald eagle population in 1982 was down to 67 because DDT was really harmful to their eggs. It would destroy the shell and the birds wouldn't be able to hatch. We're actually back up to about 20,000 bald eagles in the U.S. now, which is cool because it's our national bird. But one of the other side effects of DDT is that it's actually an effective pesticide against bedbugs. So between 1945 and 1982, bedbugs were essentially eradicated in the U.S. The ones that did survive, survived in remote areas, highly rural places where people weren't coming and going quite often and thus didn't require spraying of DDT because the government places couldn't get out there. And some that did survive were now highly resistant to the chemical class pyrethrin, which is what DDT belongs to. But for the most part, they were gone. And secondly, is that bedbug growth is actually what we would refer to as exponential, which you can kind of think of as like a hockey stick in terms of a graph. It's got a really slow incline and then eventually reaches a turning point and shoots upward. So even though we stopped using DDT in 1982, that didn't mean bedbugs came back overnight. We actually had to wait for them to grow. We had to wait for them to spread. The thing about bed bugs is they only get around on people. They're not good travelers. They're not fleas. They can't jump 50 times their own size. They don't move across the country quickly. So they have to hitchhike to get around. So even those that did survive were in isolated locations where people weren't traveling to and people there weren't traveling from. So even when we started seeing come back in 82, they weren't really going anywhere. They didn't have the ability to spread throughout the U.S. They didn't have high population numbers. They weren't growing. And so their growth was pretty slow. As far as the hockey stick graph grows, we actually reached that point about 2004. That's whenever we saw populations of bedbugs really start to return. And there's a couple reasons for this. One is the exponential growth thing. Between 82 and 2001, we saw about a 500% increase in the number of bedbugs in the U.S., which is negligible for 20 some odd years. But between 2004 and 2011, we've seen about 13,000% increase of the population size. But the real reason that they started coming back to the U.S. and started growing so heavily is unfortunately because of 9/11. After 9/11, airline companies had to drop prices dramatically to keep people being willing to fly. And whenever they did, it made it really cheap to come to the U.S. from other countries. And those other countries didn't have aggressive campaigns like the U.S. did with DDT. So people from foreign countries would bring bedbugs back into the U.S., but it also meant people could fly throughout the U.S. more cheaply. You could get a flight from DFW to JFK, and it would cost you $120 back in 2001. As a matter of fact, DFW and JFK were the two initial starting points for bedbug infestations and growth bursts in the U.S. So it was the cheapness of travel is what really brought them back. And like I said, it's slow. And yeah, from 2004 to 2011, we saw a 13,000% increase. But considering the small number we started with, 13,000 isn't still huge. We're not talking millions. But between 2011 and 2020, we're talking millions. Orkin and Terminix and every other major national pest company are all in agreement that every major urban area in the United States has an active bedbug infestation these days. So with people traveling and people going on vacation and the cheapness and relative ease that people can get around with, you know, short-term rental popping up, you've got Airbnb, vacation rental, bed and breakfasts and inns, people are spreading bed bugs and no one was prepared. No one was thinking about them. We spent 40 years not even doing research because they were eradicated in the U.S.
Wow. Perfect segue right there. Appreciate that background there. Fascinating. I think most people have not realized the history of bed bugs and just kind of that hockey stick growth, especially even up to today. So that's perfect segue to talk about Bed Bug Advisor. Tell us some more about your organization. And we also understand you have the top most preeminent experts in this arena as part of your organization.
Yeah, actually. So our founder, this guy, Gary, he got bed bugs in 2011 in his apartment and he had no clue what to do. So like anyone back then, he just turned to the internet. And as he was trying to figure out what the heck bed bugs were, which he didn't even know there were bed bugs at the time, he was just trying to figure out what this bug in his house, in his apartment was. And he was coming across a lot of contradictory information. It was really hard to separate fact from fiction and what one person's experience, why it wasn't like another person's and what the problem was. And so he just got frustrated. He wanted something to be actually accessible as a resource. And so he set out to found what is now the Bed Bug Advisor to provide a one-stop shop for all forms of education, information, treatment options, et cetera, when it comes to bed bugs. So he started doing networking in all arenas related to bed bugs. The first people he talked to were exterminators. And so we're very familiar with a lot of the exterminators. I've been in rooms with Mark Beavers, who used to be the entomologist that led up Orkin. One of the people that's actually on our advisory council is a former vice president of Terminix, who was responsible for their bed bug operations and their commercial bed bug operations. After that, he branched out. We started attending the National Pest Management Association conference on bed bugs that they hold every other year. We met up with entomologists. We're actually very well connected. Our advisory board includes people like Dr. Deanie Miller, who heads Virginia Tech's research. She is the most prolific public speaker on bed bugs, which is not really something many people look for, but she's made an appearance on Dr. Oz. Dr. Karen Vail is also huge. She does a lot of the testing for efficacy when it comes to new traps and things like that for bed bug detection, because everyone's trying to find a way to do early detection for bed bugs. Probably the most important entomologist who works directly with us is this guy named Dr. Phil Kaler. He's at the University of Florida. He's actually the person responsible for restarting bed bug research in the U.S. In the 90s, like I said, we hadn't seen him for 40 years, so no one was doing research on him. He is the patriarch of the research industry. He started doing research on him. Dr. Miller got her PhD from him. As a matter of fact, of the like eight entomologists that we have on our advisory council, seven of them either got their PhD or their master's degree working under Dr. Kaler. And then the couple of the more exciting people that we have contact with that have really helped us bridge the understanding between research and extermination and helping the everyday person, we're connected with the only medical research team in North America that actually does medical research on bedbugs. They're up in Canada, of all places. They're at the University of Toronto. And it was really fascinating talking with them specifically because they have a perspective that entomologists didn't really have to deal with. Because entomologists, they study the bugs, they try to figure out what can kill the bugs, they figure out what's effective in certain situations, but they're not dealing with the people necessarily. And exterminators, they deal with bugs all the time, so they're not having to deal with the consequences of the people either. It's get rid of the bugs, get paid. But our medical research team, they're really qualified, and they've given us a lot of insight. And we've actually been able to share some of their information with the entomologists that we know, and some of that was surprising even to them. And then Dr. Gail Ridge actually works at the Connecticut Agricultural Experimentation Station, but she has a background in psychology as well. And if you end up with bed bugs and you Google who to call to talk about, it's actually not uncommon that her name comes up. She deals with people calling her all the time, but she helped us understand a lot of the psychological impact of bed bugs, which there are quite a few and really too many to name right now. And then lastly, we are connected with the proprietor of the largest independent testing lab in the entire United States for research and testing purposes on pesticides and pest control management. So whenever you want to get a new pesticide onto the market or a new trap onto the market, you do your own internal testing, then you see it's successful, you go to a university, you get university testing done, and then finally you turn it over to this guy's lab. They do the testing for independent research verification, and they write the report for the EPA, and then you get your EPA label. So we know what products work and what don't because we've got the guy who tests them all, and he talks us through his testing protocol, and we have some very rigorous science backing all of our recommendations on what to actually do. So we take all of those disparate areas of knowledge and information, and we try to make it something that's usable for the everyday person, like an innkeeper, for example.
That's great. Awesome.
Wow. So just to step back a little bit, Brian, talk about, and this is probably a good segue into, you know, the innkeeper perspective and what they need to know, but talk about the physical aspects of the bed bug, what they look like, you know, that sort of thing, and, you know, how you know you've got them, and also that psychological aspect, because that was something I had never heard of. So maybe you can start with the physical and then also talk about why it can be a psychological problem if you've been bitten by bed bugs before.
Yeah, that's actually pretty fascinating. So one of the things I've encountered in my role as the public educator with bed bugs and in charge of our communication for the bed bug advisor is that most people actually think bed bugs are microscopic. Based on the stories and everything they've heard about them and all the nursery rhymes, they just think you can't see them. They're like mites. But in reality, bed bugs are visible to the naked eye. They're the size of an apple seed and they're about the color of an apple seed when fully grown. At their earliest stages, bed bugs have 5 life cycle stages. They're a translucent yellow. They're not invisible. They're pretty small, though, but you can see them with your naked eye. And then when fully grown, they are the size of an apple seed, and they get this dark brown and reddish color, and they're oval-shaped. So the key distinguishing features of a bed bug are that they have 6 legs. They have 2 short antennae. So if you see long antennae that look like whiskers, it's not a bed bug. They've got the oval body shape that comes to a point at the bottom. And then they've got ridging along the back. You'll see 7 or 8 horizontal lines all down the back of that oval as a key distinguishing characteristic of bed bugs. And then lastly, their heads are connected directly to their bodies. There's no neck or neck separation for a bed bug. So that's what you're really looking for. 6 legs, so you don't have to worry about spiders. They've got the antenna, so they're distinct from ticks. They're visible to the naked eye, and they've got a very distinct color. There's a lot of bugs that people confuse for bed bugs. The most common one is carpet beetles. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One, anytime someone sees a bug in a bed, they're going to think it's a bed bug because of the name bed bugs. Well, carpet beetles feed on hair fibers and, you know, fiber in general. So they'll be in your bed because they'll be on your pillows. And carpet beetles cause an allergic reaction for most people. They don't bite anyone, but the contact causes most people to itch. So they'll think that they're bed bugs. And carpet beetles are oval shaped as well. So people think that they're bed bugs because they share a similar body shape. But carpet beetles have kind of like a black and white camo back. They're not reddish brown. They don't have the ridging and they don't have antenna. So that's the most common misidentification that happens. But yeah, so bed bugs, those are your features. The other thing is that bed bugs, this is kind of creepy, they feed on human blood. That's the only thing that they can use to reproduce and molt from one stage to the next. They have to feed on human blood. And because they're semi-translucent, you can see it. So if they fed, they're going to have bright red blood inside of them. So even at the younger stages, when they're that yellowish translucent, if they've been biting, it's really easy to spot them because they've got some bright red spots on their back. Now, one of the other reasons people think that they're microscopic is because bed bugs are just notoriously good at hiding. They're the world winners of hide and seek. They can fit in cracks as thin as a business card. They'll get in anywhere. One of the harder things I had to do, I had a guy who swore up and down he had bed bugs, and I spent 2.5 hours in his apartment each time. And it's a single bedroom apartment. Actually, it wasn't even a single bedroom. It was just a studio apartment. And I went 3 different times spread out 2 weeks apart looking for signs of bed bugs. And I couldn't find any. And, you know, I'm spending a total of 9-10 hours in this place until he catches one. And he shows it to me. I said, oh yeah, you got bed bugs. What had happened was he, instead of having a box spring, he actually slept on plywood. And the bed bugs had gotten into the cracks between the layers of plywood because plywood is just pressed sawdust. And so one of the layers had cracked and it was just inside the plywood, which made it impossible to find. Until I cracked the plywood in half, it was impossible to find a bed bug. So That's why people think they're microscopic. They're so good at hiding, they'll hide anywhere. They'll hide inside walls, they'll hide inside a headboard, they'll hide inside your mattress frame, they'll hide inside electrical outlets. So it can be pretty hard to find them. Now, to tell that you've got them, there are a couple ways. Obviously, one is catching the bed bug itself. That's difficult for a bunch of reasons, not least of which is that they're good at hiding. But second is bed bugs, like all other things, including, unfortunately, our wives, they poop. And when they poop, they leave fecal stains, and they're small little black dots, and they're usually congregated into one area where you'll see a minimum of like 8 or so, because they return to the same areas to poop. And you can find those on the corners of mattresses and box frames. If you're looking at a mattress, you'll actually want to pull up the piping, the circular thing that goes around the edge of the mattress, and because they like to hide under there, and that's where they're set up what we call a harborage, and that's where they go to stay and rest, and after they've had their good meal for their day, and to get busy trying to make new bed bugs. But they'll have fecal excretion. And there's a lot of black dots that will appear on mattresses. So it's hard to be like, oh, I see a black dot. It's a bed bug. One, it's tiny. It's like if you took a pen and you just tapped it on a sheet of paper, that's about the size of one of the dots. So anything larger, probably an ink stain or whatever, you're not going to have to be too worried about it. But if you're unsure as to whether or not these dots are bed bugs, one of the tricks is you can take a white washcloth or a paper towel and you can wet the corner of it and rub the dots. They're fecal stains, but they're dried human blood. So it'll smear red and you'll get some red contact onto whatever white material you're using, even if you can't get it to smear on the actual mattress itself. And so if it doesn't smear red, it's not a bed bug stain. Smears red, likely blood, you might have a problem.
So now, if I'm an innkeeper, it's got to be one of your worst nightmares is to find out that you've got bed bugs because you've done everything right. You've got the perfect bed and breakfast in and another guest brings the bed bugs in. I mean, they got to come in some way. And it's like you say, it's only through humans. So it's, it's probably that's what's happened. It seems to me that you're going to get lucky if you happen to notice, if you even like listen to this podcast and you know what to look for, or you go online to Bed Bug Advisor and get information that way or whatever. Seems like you're going to be lucky if you happen to see something that tells you, oh, wow, I might have bed bugs. Is it not the case that most of the time it's guests that are saying, hey, I got bitten by a bed bug at your place? Is that, or maybe not, maybe I'm wrong.
You're onto something here. There is an element of luck to it because bed bugs are so good at hiding. You've got to be good or lucky or rather unlucky to catch the size of one. But if you're vigilant and you have a trained housekeeping staff that whenever they're doing turnover and changing bed sheets, they do, quick inspections at the spots that bed bugs are likely to have stained, like the corners of the mattresses I was talking about, whenever they take the fitted sheet off, that might be a way to do an early inspection. And there are tools that we can discuss later that can also help with the early inspection. But one of the things that I've experienced, and I've done a little bit of work with innkeepers, but my primary group that I've been working with has been short-term rentals. I'd say about 70% of the time that a guest reports that they are dealing with bed bugs, they're wrong. It's very common. People think there's a bug in the bed. It's got to be a bed bug. People think, oh, I've got a welt on my arm or something that appears like a bite. It's got to be a bed bug. But it could be another bug. It can be a carpet beetle. It could be an allergic reaction. I had one group who had guests that had an allergic reaction to the detergent they were using. And because they were staying in an Airbnb for the second time in their lives and they don't use that detergent at home, they had no clue. They just woke up with rash all over their body. So they thought it was bed bugs, but it was just an allergic reaction. So it's about 70% of the time, it's not really a bed bug. And about of that 30% where it is a bed bug, I'd say only about 80% of that, know enough to say something and be right and aren't just trying to scam a free night out of wherever they're staying, because people will want a refund, legitimate, because you don't want to stay in a bed bug infested place. But it's not uncommon to have a guest report bed bugs and be wrong, but you should take it seriously in the event that it is real. So you should do, thorough inspections.
Okay. So let's say I'm an innkeeper and I verify that I've got bed bugs. What's next for me? What do I need to do at that point?
If you verify you've got bed bugs, you need to move the guest out of the room, obviously, but you need to be careful because like I said, bed bugs move on people. So you've got to be thorough in making sure that they don't take them to wherever you're moving them to, because you don't want to infest multiple units from the same group. So one of the things that's true about bed bugs is they die when exposed to high levels of heat. kind of like humans do. If we get 108 degrees, we're going to die, but we don't usually get that hot even when it's 120 outside. Bed bugs die when they get up to 113. And so what you can do is you can have the people take their luggage, go to your on-site laundry room and throw everything in a dryer. You don't need to wash it. As a matter of fact, washing it may just actually risk infesting your washers. But if you throw it in the dryer and run their, you know, laundry on high heat for 30 minutes, you'll kill all stages of bed bugs. And this can be done with luggage if you've got industrial sized dryers. But if not, you know, you can always try to find a laundromat, or you can store their luggage itself in plastic bins, because bed bugs have a hard time climbing out of plastic. But you're going to want to move them to another room. The second thing you're going to want to do is immediately call for professional help. Unfortunately, if you look on the internet for people who've dealt with bed bugs for themselves, you're going to run into what psychologists refer to as the confirmation bias phenomenon, which is that survivorship bias. It's also kind of confirmation bias, but survivorship. Only the people who succeed at killing bed bugs themselves are going to share their stories about having killed bed bugs themselves. You're not going to find online the story of the person who tried for a year and a half doing every trick on the internet before they finally gave up and called an exterminator. So do-it-yourself isn't actually a very viable option. I'd say less than 1% of do-it-yourselfers are successful, based on the number of times I've had people come to me and ask for help doing it yourself after they've been trying for 10, 11 months. But professionals. And then your options become a little bit more expansive. It depends on how long you've had the infestation, the size of the infestation. If you have someone who brings in a bed bug and they are the kind of person who reacts to bed bug bites, and they wake up the next morning and they show you and you've caught it early, what we refer to as an introduction instead of an infestation, then, you know, you're lucky, because now you're dealing with one problem. It's a small problem. They haven't grown in population yet. They've only had one night worth of feeding, and you can deal with that pretty easily. But exterminators and professionals, pest management professionals, will be able to determine the size of a bed bug problem. So you usually want to get on the phone, have one come out. Almost everyone we've talked to, including all of the national chains like Orkin and Terminix, they will do inspections for free. They'll inspect not only to make sure it's actually bed bugs, but how big the problem is if you have bed bugs. And companies do this because they want to be the ones to get your business. So if you don't have one in your area, if you call someone and they want to charge you for an inspection, hang up and call someone else. You'll find someone who will do a free inspection. Because knowing the size of the problem also can help you determine whether or not it's likely to have spread to other units that you're in. There was a study by Rutgers. They were actually studying in apartments and multifamily housing. But given enough time, bed bug populations seek new sources of food, obviously, because you can't all feed on the same person. And after about a month of population growth, bed bugs will move to other nearby units. So in an apartment, they will go up, down, left, right, and across the hall. So from one infestation, if you let it linger long enough, you can actually infest 5 units. So you want to get an inspection to determine how big the size is, how likely it is to have spread to your other units, and then what remediation treatment type is most applicable for your situation.
You were talking about misinformation. There's probably some scamming type stuff out there, I guess. I don't know. But you know, based upon the equipment that's really needed to do the heat mitigation or whatever you call it, you know, seems like there could be the potential for someone to not charge for the initial inspection or whatever, and then claim that you do have bed bugs, but not really. I'm just wondering how you keep an eye, like, obviously, if you go with the larger type company, you're probably in good shape, but maybe not all innkeepers are in places where that's available. I don't know. How do you really know that you're getting somebody who knows about bed bugs and can really deal with the issue if you really, and identify for sure that you've got it as well?
So there's two ways that people do inspections, and this is a valid question. This is a question I get often. How do I know that this company is not scamming me and just lying and saying I have bed bugs, so I'll pay them the whatever money for the treatment? And it's legitimate. One, if you know what the signs of bed bugs are, you know, what to look for, if you've listened to the podcast, or maybe you visit our website, or maybe you've talked to someone who's had personal experience, you can ask them to explain to you why they think that you have bed bugs. Ask them to show you the signs themselves, because they're not just going to go in and base it on intuition. They're going to have evidence. So maybe they'll find a cast skin. Like I said, bed bugs have 5 life cycle stages, and they shed their skin like a snake when they move between each one. So that's the sign of bed bugs. You can find their old skins. Second one is obvious if you run into a bed bug itself. You know, you've obviously got bed bugs. And then, like I said, you've got those fecal stains that can be identified as bed bug stains. So if you call in a professional and you're wary as to whether or not they're just trying to get your business, even though you don't need their business, ask them to walk you through how they confirmed it. There's two ways that people do confirmations. The one is the visual inspection. They get on hand and knee and they check all the places for the signs of bed bugs. And then the second is trained dogs. Dogs can actually be trained to identify the scent of bed bugs and they can alert based upon that. If this were 2011, I wouldn't be recommending dogs because there was some training issues and it was really difficult. But in the last 9 years, dogs have actually taken a really large step forward as far as a positive, no false positive identification route for bed bugs. So maybe you want to find someone who has a dog, maybe you want to find someone who does visual inspections, but if they're using a dog, it'll be harder for you to verify that you've actually got signs of bed bugs. So maybe you want to stick with people who do visual inspections, but have those people show you what evidence they found that led them to believe that you have bed bugs.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So any more that you think's worth talking about in terms of treatments and treatment options, or, you know, you think you've kind of covered the bases there? Are there any other options? I mean, it sounds like the heat thing is the only sure way of doing this.
Well, there are a lot of options for bed bugs. Unfortunately, it all kind of depends on your situation. Heat is pretty surefire. They die once they get hot enough, but there are failure rates. And that's not because heat doesn't kill bed bugs, it's because you've got a technician failure. And that's really the only way heat will fail is if equipment or someone messes up. There are three main categories of ways to deal with bed bugs when it comes to remediation. The first is heat. And what will happen with a heat treatment is people will bring in generators and they'll usually bring in generators, possibly it could be propane heat, but almost certainly it's going to be electric heat. They'll bring in a truck with electric generators and then they'll bring in electric heaters. And they'll stick them throughout the room, and then they'll bring in fans to circulate the air. Because, yes, it gets hot, but it needs to get hot in all of the right places. Because if there's a cold spot where bed bugs can hide, like under a pile of towels, then they'll go there and they'll be able to survive a heat treatment. One of the actual first heat treatments that we were able to see, we had a technician who heated a room up to about 165 degrees, which is way over what we normally use. The industry standard's about 135 to 145. And he got up to 165, and it was actually so hot that he melted a TV off of the wall. It was a 32-inch flat screen LCD, and it got so hot that it melted the actual TV screen. But when we were done, we went back in. This was an apartment unit, and there was a pile of clothes that the resident had left on the floor. And we pulled the pile of clothes away, and live bed bugs came crawling out because they were able to survive by getting in between all the layer of clothes where the heat couldn't penetrate. So they'll bring in fans to circulate the air, and they'll generally go back in every 30 minutes to an hour to move stuff around to make sure there aren't any cold spots. And heat treatments can be somewhat expensive. They run between $35 to $55 per square foot whenever you're trying to heat. So if you're treating like a one-bedroom in unit, I'm thinking hotel here, it can run you $1,500 for one unit. But it's fairly surefire. The only failure rate is technician failure. The second option, which is cheaper, but in some ways far more expensive, are chemical treatments. I said that they had developed a resistance to DDT, but we now have several different chemical options that are on the market. And most pest management companies will do what's called integrated pest management, which means they'll use different chemicals at the same time. That way, if a bed bug is resistant to one type of chemical, it's not resistant to the other and it dies off instead of creating super bugs that are resistant, you know, Crossfire or Temperate. But not necessarily both. Now, chemical treatments are cheaper than heat treatments because they don't have to pay for generators and equipment and blah, blah, blah. But they can be more expensive in a lot of ways. One, chemical treatments usually can't get started for about 2 weeks after the initial inspection because there's such a backlog in actually licensed exterminators and the ability to perform the chemical treatments because of the EPA regulations. So you're going to have to be waiting 2 weeks before anyone even comes out to start treatment, which can be quite killer in our industry where you've got to shut down the room for 2 weeks and you don't have turnover. But the real reason is that it actually takes multiple treatments to effectively eradicate a bed bug population. The average number of treatments for chemicals is 2.4. So you're looking somewhere between 2 and 3 treatments before they're actually gone, and treatments have to be spaced out 2 weeks apart. So if you're doing a chemical treatment, not only do you have to wait however long it is before you can get someone out to inspect, you generally have to wait 2 weeks before they even start the treatment. And then you're waiting between 4 weeks and 6 weeks for them to be finished. So you're shutting down your room for 2 months if you're dealing with a chemical treatment, unless you want to risk infesting your your new guests, which obviously creates both a legal liability and a moral issue. So you know, obviously I don't recommend that. And that can be expensive in many other ways. The last option, and this is the nuke them from orbit option, is fumigation. If you had bedbug infestation and 103 or whatever, and you weren't able to handle it in time, because the sad reality is that a large percentage of people don't react to bedbug bites. At least half of Americans, and between 70 and 90% in reality, don't show a visible reaction to bedbug bites. So you can have bedbugs in a unit for weeks on end before you finally get someone who shows a reaction and says something. And if you've had a problem long enough that it's spread to every unit in your inn, you're going to need to fumigate. And fumigation is very expensive because they have to build the tents custom for every place because not every place is the same. And so you've got to wait for them to build the tent. You've got to pay them to build the tent. They'll come out for 48 hours and fumigate the place. And that, we're talking tens of thousands of dollars if you have to nuke them from orbit.
So Brian, speaking of people, you know, not knowing that they've been bitten, what about the psychological aspects of bed bugs and biting people?
Wow. So this is actually really fascinating and something that we, and by we, I mean the entire research community, just learned pretty recently. We've always known that there's been psychological issues with bed bugs. They're creepy. They're gross. People feel attacked in their own bed. But what we learned is that bed bug bites cause psychological issues for people, even if they are part of that large population that don't show reactions to bed bug bites. So to back up a little, bed bugs cause something very similar to PTSD. We are hesitant to call it PTSD because generally speaking, as a society, we associate that with highly traumatic events involving war or violence or sexual violence or something of that nature. So we don't want to downplay the severity of that likelihood. But when it comes to bed bugs, you'll see very common symptoms associated with PTSD. People will have heightened levels of anxiety. They'll have restlessness. They'll have flashbacks. They'll have paranoia. I know someone who got rid of bedbugs 5 years ago who still constantly swats their leg anytime it itches because a breeze crossed the leg hairs. It's very common for people to become stressed out when it comes to bedbugs. And before 2016, we always thought, hey, it's gross. It's something you deal with in your bed. You should feel safest in your bed. No one wants to look at them. They're hard to get rid of, so it has a lasting impact. But actually, what we learned from that medical research team up in Canada is that bedbugs have a physiological component as well that contributes to bedbug bites, causing psychological issues. So the first thing that you have to know about bedbugs is that a lot of people believe them to be nocturnal, but that's not technically accurate. Bedbugs actually attack you whenever you're asleep and you've been at rest for about 3 hours. Now, oftentimes that'll mean they're nocturnal because humans are nocturnal, and that's whenever we sleep, but they're not afraid of light. You can actually find them out in the day. If people take a nap during the day, that means that they're likely to be at risk. So bedbugs wait till you've been asleep or at rest for about 3 hours. Now, side note here about the way that humans work, whenever we sleep, the only actual restful sleep that we get is something called rapid eye movement or REM sleep. And our body cycles through different phases of sleep, but the ones that actually rejuvenate us and make us feel better in the morning is the REM sleep. Well, the first REM cycle starts about 3 hours into sleeping, which is when bedbugs bite us. Bedbugs won't, generally speaking, wake you up from their bites in the sense that you'll actually be aroused and sit up in bed and whatnot, but they do activate your brain, which takes it out of REM sleep. So a bedbug bite will actually make you skip your first REM cycle at night, and you'll wake up feeling less rested. The second thing is that bedbug bites cause a chemical reaction in our bodies to release cortisol, which is the stress hormone. So natural reaction, fight or flight instinct, our body releases cortisol, which triggers adrenaline production, and you know, we get out of the situation. But someone who doesn't have a physical or visible reaction to bedbug bites, they don't have bumps appear on their bodies or whatever, doesn't actually mean that they're safe from the psychological impacts of bedbugs. You'll still awaken feeling less rested. You'll feel stressed out. But the thing is, if you're one of the people who doesn't react, you'll have no idea why. So even if you don't show symptoms, you'll still feel the stress effects of bedbugs, which is kind of terrifying. And one of the reasons we had to deal so heavily with this bug is because it's such a nuisance and such a threat. We call them nightmarish. We actually once did a word cloud on a research of about 1,500 people in discussing bedbugs. And other than some language I don't really feel comfortable sharing on a podcast, the third most common word used in these discussions was actually hell. People described them as a living hell, that it was a hellish experience, that it was like living to hell with bed bugs. It's terrifying. It is absolutely terrifying. They're not comfortable for people. And it makes sense why guests would be concerned about them, because they are really harming, not only in a financial sense for us as innkeepers, but also in a psychological sense for someone who actually has to deal with their bites.
Wow. How long does that physical or the psychological issue that's based upon the physical, the chemical aspects of it, how long does that last after you've been bitten by the bed bug?
As long as you're getting bitten. As far as the physiological components, as long as you remain getting bitten, your body will still react in the same fashion. So if you are able to successfully treat your problem and get it rid of, you'll be able to return to a normal sleep cycle. You won't have your REM sleep interrupted, and your body will stop the excess production of cortisol. You can expect levels to return to normal, I think, and you can't quote me on this one because this is something I'm just trying to call from memory from talking with the professors, but I think it's about 2 weeks before cortisol levels return to normal. But as far as the psychological aspects goes, that can follow people for years. I mean, legitimately.
Yeah, makes sense. So if I'm an innkeeper, the best thing for me is to avoid bed bugs at all costs and never have an infestation problem, right? So what can I do to prevent bed bugs? Even though it sounds to me like, again, you could do everything, you know, be the most preventive innkeeper out there, but still end up with them because a guest happens to bring one in or bring some in or whatever. But still, you know, in being proactive, what can I do to prevent bed bugs?
Well, short of turning your inn into one of those experience resorts where people go to have an experience, and that experience happens to be delousing in a prison where you make everyone strip and then deal with them and get rid of their clothes and whatnot, it's going to be difficult. Prevention is the golden goose, and I really wish there was a silver bullet. But the good thing about this is I can tell you that if anyone tries to sell you a silver bullet when it comes to bed bugs, they're selling you snake oil. There are effective strategies for mitigation, though. So one of the things I mentioned earlier on the podcast is that we make a distinction between an introduction and an infestation. An infestation is an actively growing bedbug population of at least 25 bugs. They've got 5 life cycle stages. They can only reproduce when they're fully grown adults. They have to feed to move between each of the stages, and there have to be a male and a female, and feedings are spaced out about 4 to 6 days per bug. So you can have someone who brings in a nymph, 2 nymph bed bugs, and they grow, and it takes them 2 months before they reach adulthood and whatnot, and they're both male, and that's the end of the problem. Eventually, they just die off from old age, and you don't have a problem. You could have someone who brings in an adult male and an adult female bed bug, and they start feeding immediately, and they double in size every 10 days, which means at the end of 2 months, you're dealing with 1,024 bed bugs. So when it comes to prevention, because they come in on people and we can't screen our guests and we can't throw their clothes into the furnace as much as we would like to sometimes, we need to do early detection. Early detection is really the best strategy for bed bugs. So one, that can be something like training your housekeeping staff to be able to search for and identify signs of bed bugs quickly whenever they're doing turnover. And two, it can just mean using the available tools and resources that are out there that can help you detect a bed bug problem before it actually becomes an infestation. So that's probably the best combination, proper training of your innkeeping staff and using some of the tools that are on the market that can be used to be more effective at prevention.
Okay. And what are some of those tools?
Oh, that's probably a 30-minute conversation. I'll try to go through some a little bit more quickly, though.
Well, just give us one or two so that innkeepers can know the type of stuff that might be out there and, you know, what you think and the scientists on board and as part of your organization, what they feel might be the best way to go.
If I were to give just 2 products, the first would be a bed bug bite barrier. There's something on the market already that's called encasements, and people will think these are similar, but in reality, they're very distinct. So encasements are like sleeves you put on your mattress or your box springs, and then you zip them shut, and bed bugs can't get in or out of encasements. As you may have gleaned from the conversation so far, bed bugs is kind of a misnomer, which literally means to be misnamed. They don't stay necessarily confined to your bed. They can come from anywhere. They can come from the walls or whatnot. So encasements will seal off your mattress and will keep bed bugs from getting in and out, but that won't really stop a problem. It'll just, you know, keep your mattress looking pristine. and any bugs that are trapped inside the encasement won't be able to bite, so it quote unquote stops bed bug bites. Those are useful to some extent, but they don't really do what you really need them to do. Now, I mention them because the bed bug bite barrier is something that's going to sound similar to an encasement, but it does something radically different. So a bed bug bite barrier, these are specifically designed sheets that go on top of mattresses, and you can get some that are just top sheets that hang down, and I'll explain a little bit more later, or you can get some that are actually fitted sheets, so you can put them on the bottom and then make your bed up normally over them. And bed bug bite barriers have two components to them. One, the top surface that people are going to be sleeping on is just like a normal cloth material, so it's like a sheet that would be comfortable to sleep on. You can make them out of any. But the underside of that is coated with a bite-proof material. So any bed bugs that are on top of the mattress but not on top of the, you know, sheets and bedding and whatnot won't actually be able to bite through it to bite anyone that's sleeping on top of the sheet. That does half the work, because the other half is keeping them from getting to the top of the actual bedding structure where the humans are and the pillows and whatnot. And the bite barrier comes with a bed skirt attached to it. So for the top sheet, it's literally just a sheet that hangs off the top, like an extra size sheet that hangs down the sides. And the bottom foot is this bed skirt that's coated with a material that bed bugs are unable to climb. So bed bugs have hook-like feet. And we talk about something being a quote-unquote slippery surface. It's not slippery the way you or I would think of it. We would think of something slick like a bowling alley where it's hard to get, you know, a step on and we slide or whatever. But for bed bugs, because their feet are hooks, it's just about creating material they can't create enough leverage to pull themselves up on. So you can feel it and it's like kind of rough, but it'd be like you or I trying to walk up a wall. It's a rough material, but we can't walk up it. Same with bed bugs. Now, the fitted sheets, those go in deeper than a regular fitted sheet, and then attached to the elastic that pulls it in is the skirt, and then the skirt comes out and hangs down the sides. So a bite barrier, one, it does what it says it does. Any bed bugs that aren't on the top surface will be trapped, and they won't be able to bite your guests. So if you can eliminate bites, you can eliminate the problem, because they won't be able to grow, they won't be able to reproduce, and you won't have guests complaining about bed bug bites. But even if someone does get around, let's say someone brings in their luggage and it's in their suitcase and they set their suitcase on top of the bed and the bed bug climbs out and then it hides and waits till night. The cool thing about bed bugs, what we've learned in our research, is that they'll bite someone, but then they'll naturally go to hide and they'll try to leave the surface. They don't want to stay on top of the mattress because that's where they're most likely to be detected. So even in the situation where you have someone bring them in and they get bit and then the bed bug goes to hide, it will do so, and then it'll get trapped again, because now it'll be outside of the bed, and when it tries to climb back up, it's not going to be able to climb that bed skirt, and it'll get stuck again, and it won't be able to get to your people. So the first tool that we think is most effective by far is the bed bug bite barrier. They can't bite, they can't reproduce, which means the problem's not growing, and you're not having to deal with guests, and you solve the bites, you solve the problem. But they're not perfect. Like I said, there are many different ways that people can leave a pillow on the floor or whatever. The second one, since I'm only naming two, are traps. Now, there's a bunch of different traps on the market. Don't get glue traps, flat out. No matter what promises they make, no matter what they say they've shown in testing, glue traps are just decisively ineffective. There are a category of traps called pitfall traps. And the brand names for these, I think, are Climb-Ups and Blackouts. There's a couple different companies that make them. Those are circular dishes that you can like place under the foot of a bed. And there's a moat. So on the outside, there's this ramp that bed bugs can climb up, and then there's a sharp drop with like an inch wide moat, and then there's the inner circle where you can actually place the foot of the bed into. Climb-ups operate similarly to a bite barrier in some capacity, which is that the moat they can fall into, but they can't climb out of because it doesn't have a stable foothold for them. Now, the reason I like climb-up traps or blackouts, it won't solve your problem. Like I said, there's ways for them to get onto a bed other than climbing up the foot of the bed, but they help with early detection. A study by Dr. Karen Vail, who I mentioned earlier, showed that between 95 and 98% of bed bug introductions were able to be detected by climb-up traps. And here's the actual neat thing about that study. She followed what she refers to as the Rutgers protocol, because Dr. Cooper over at Rutgers started doing this. They would actually take a pitfall trap and they would just place it up against a wall. They wouldn't necessarily put it under the foot of furniture, although that is a way to use it and that's how they're designed. They just place it along a baseboard and bed bugs would travel along the baseboard, and then they have a natural instinct to climb upwards whenever they can. So they reach the ramp, they climb up, they fall into the trap, and they get identified. So they were able to use a single trap just placed along a wall and accurately identify 98% of bed bug introduction. So you catch them early, you're dealing with a much easier problem. They haven't grown out of hand. They haven't necessarily been biting your guests. They're unlikely to have gone home with some of your guests, and they haven't spread to other rooms. So the bite barrier helps keep the populations low, and the bite barriers are washable and dryable. You can, you know, use them like your regular laundry, or you can stick your regular bedding on top of it and just never touch the stuff. Just leave it in place forever if you're using one of the fitted sheet ones. And that'll help slow the population growth. It'll help stop the bites. And the traps will help you do early identification. So as far as I would recommend, those are the two. I do want to make a point to explicitly recommend that you don't buy sprays. There are a lot of sprays on the market. A lot of people want to sell you sprays. A lot of people will make fantastical promises about sprays. Sprays are effectively ineffective for us to use. Bed bugs can be killed on contact by sprays, but they can also be killed on contact with soap and water, your thumb, or a hammer. The issue with bed bugs isn't killing them, it's finding them in the first place.
Right. Yeah, that makes total sense. So I guess it used to be that there was the old joke about, what is it, that if there was a nuclear war, that the only thing left living would be roaches and Keith Richards. So is that the case with maybe bed bugs and Keith Richards and roaches or whatever? But I mean, even though these things seem to have been gone, you know, for about 40 some years, you know, they were still hanging out. And of course, as the world becomes more connected and mobile, people are more mobile and everything. Even if there was some attempted eradication again in the United States, it doesn't sound like that would prevent the entire problem. So is it fair enough to say that bed bugs are probably going to be around forever, or at least in our lifetime?
Until that nuclear war comes, I can't imagine a scenario where we solve the bed bug problem. Entomologists and researchers are trying new things all the time. One of the more recent developments is that there's been historically a fungus we've used to eradicate cockroaches for about 20 years, and people have been trying to modulate that fungus to be effective against bed bugs. So we're trying everything. We're trying to use anything we can to get rid of bed bugs. But because they're a global problem, and honestly, it's a largely a cultural thing, there are some cultures where bed bugs don't actually have the psychological impacts that they do have on Americans and Europeans and Africans. There are some communities in the subcontinent, India, for example, that they've lived with bed bugs for so long that it's actually just a natural part of their life cycle, and it doesn't impact the people that live there. And because that's the case, I don't think there's ever going to be a successful global campaign to rid ourselves of bed bugs. And because the only way to get rid of bed bugs that we have now also impact other things like those, you know, bald eagle bird eggs, I don't think we'll ever have another successful campaign in the U.S. either. Bed bugs are here. They're here to stay, and they're growing with a vengeance.
Yeah, sounds like it. Before we wrap up, talk a little bit. You talked about Bed Bug Advisor in terms of what you all do. Just to be totally clear and upfront with everybody listening, what is your, I guess, profit model? Because you do some things in order to make money, but you're mostly into free education, just like what you're doing with us today. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, let's be real. We're a company. Obviously, we got to do something. We do the free education stuff as part of a branding effort. We want to get our name out there. And like I said about Gary, he was actually very genuinely motivated to try to create a resource for victims of bed bugs. And he wanted to expand the scope of what constitutes a victim to be beyond the people who simply have bed bug bites. He was thinking owners of apartments or hotels or even innkeepers are victims of bed bugs, even if you're not necessarily the ones getting bitten. So to some extent, there is some altruism there, but obviously we're also motivated by profit. Our website, we run ads, Google ads. If you click on an ad on our page, we get a profit, and we would like to drive people to our website, both as an educational resource and more people that see our ads, and we get paid, obviously. And then we do affiliate programs. Because of our connection with that testing lab, we know what products work and we know which ones don't. And so we actually sell, quote unquote, some of them off of our website, and we get a small margin kickback based on the sales of those products. I think right now the only thing we actually have up on our website are, in fact, bite barriers, because those are the things that we honestly think are the most effective tools and the most in need. But at this moment, I believe we only have the travel version available. We're going to be working on expanding that. But we had all different kinds of bedbug products and affiliate programs. We even were with Amazon for a period of time. And I think we're going to be going back to them soon to help sponsor what we think are the most effective tools that are being sold off Amazon. And, you know, they give us pennies on the dollar, not even pennies. They give us tens of pennies on the dollar for every sale that we make through our website. But that's really where profit comes from. We're not looking to be a multi-million-dollar business based off of this. We're, you know, we're looking to educate people and maybe make some money on the way.
Well, I think you've done an incredible job with that, with doing that in the podcast today, and extremely informative. And I know you could, like you said, you know, just on the topic of prevention, you could spend 30 minutes or whatever, and you probably could have spent 30 minutes on every topic that we talked about or more. But I think there's been so much information that hopefully is really helpful. I think it will be to innkeepers who are listening, or even aspiring innkeepers, because like you say, this is a problem that's not going to go away. And so phenomenal amount of information. So very much appreciate that. Matt, you want to get us towards the end line here?
Sure thing. Yeah, no, this has been great. Thank you, Brian, so much for the time. And before I do my little outro and our little sign off here, we always ask, is there anything else to add or anything we may have missed?
There is only one other thing I'd like to add. If you go on the internet and you look for ways to kill bed bugs, one of the most common things you'll run across is people telling you to use rubbing alcohol because it'll kill bed bugs. Like I said before, so will a thumb and a hammer. Unlike a thumb and a hammer, rubbing alcohol is flammable. So if you actually Google rubbing alcohol bed bugs fire, you'll find stories of people who set entire apartment buildings on fire. And so my key takeaway that I make sure to give everyone every time I do one of these speaking engagements is, for the love of God, do not use rubbing alcohol. It doesn't matter what the internet says. Stop lighting places on fire. Please. There are better ways to kill them.
Sounds like
yeah, that's it.
That's a great way to end this interview. And That's probably the most germane and very important tip of the day right there, Brian. You saved the hit song for the very end. That was excellent. And for all of our listeners, you just heard an exclusive Frictionless Innkeeper podcast interview with Brian Ontiveros Kirsch with Bedbug Advisor, which, as you heard, is a specialized organization that provides public education and resources for the treatment and elimination of bedbugs. And as you heard, Brian was kind enough to share insights and really provide an enlightening discussion on the issue of bedbugs in the hospitality arena and what innkeepers can do to prevent and mitigate bedbugs at their properties. And we hope you really enjoyed this episode of the Frictionless Innkeeper podcast, brought to you by the Frictionless Guest app. If you wish to learn more, please visit frictionlessguest.com. Once again, that's frictionlessguest.com. And Brian and Steve, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Thank you, Brian. We really appreciate it. A lot of great stuff.